Welcome to the Deep Dive. Specifically, you're listening to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a topic that, well, it really underpins our hyper-connected world, ubiquitous technical surveillance, or UTS. In this modern era, it's increasingly clear that we aren't just observed anymore. We are, in a very real sense, quantified. Our mission for this deep dive is to dissect the invisible architecture of UTS. We want to peel back the layers, explore how privacy is being eroded, often by design. We'll examine how our everyday interactions, both the ones we volunteer for, you know, clicking accept, and those we're kind of coerced into, how they fuel this vast, ever-expanding ecosystem of data-driven control. This deep dive will interrogate that unsettling convergence of security, commerce, and control. Everything from, say, algorithmic profiling to the cutting edge of emotional surveillance, and even digging into counterterrorism's complex moral gray zones. And for more actionable knowledge and insights into strategic security policy, we definitely invite you to visit thesecuritynexus.net. The Security Nexus is a Maryland-based national security consultancy.
We specialize in strategic advisory, education, and public engagement. We provide insight into the evolving landscape of cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, basically trying to keep folks informed. Our mission is really to inform, educate, and empower both professionals and the public through clear, accessible, importantly, actionable knowledge.
And we've got quite a lineup of source material to guide us today. It's a really intricate landscape. We'll be exploring contributions from, well, a range of insightful authors and researchers, people like Dong Zhang, Antti Ylisvirta, Alan Munuriyarwa, Bruce Schneier, Simon Hoag. A lot of great work. But kind of serving as a central pillar for our discussion today is a really pivotal article by Sergio Sanchez. He's the CEO of the Security Nexus. His piece is titled Ubiquitous Technical Surveillance, Counterintelligence Bliss or Nightmare. And his work truly frames the critical questions we need to grapple with as we navigate this new reality.
Okay, so let's unpack this. When we talk about surveillance, you know, maybe our minds jump to old spy movies or just security cameras on street corners, but ubiquitous technical surveillance, UPS, it sounds like something far more pervasive than just being watched. You said it's about our lives being quantified. What exactly defines this new reality? What makes it so different?
That's a great place to start, because it really is a fundamental shift. At its core, as Sergio Sanchez defines it, ubiquitous technical surveillance is an environment where a person's every action gets collected, saved, searched, correlated, and analyzed. Think about that. Every single action. This isn't like traditional surveillance, which usually targets, you know, a specific person for a specific reason, maybe for a limited time. UTS is about constant, all-encompassing data collection. And what powers this shift are these incredible technological leaps, things like the Internet of Things, the IoT, where countless everyday devices are interconnected, constantly communicating, massive advances in wireless communication, like 5G networks, which allow for enormous data transfer speeds, and the burgeoning capabilities of quantum computing, which can process just vast amounts of information almost instantaneously. These technologies allow for near real-time processing of truly immense quantities of data, creating this unprecedented level of detailed information about individuals.
And what's really, I guess, unsettling here is the idea that this powerful new reality is also paradoxically kind of invisible. We don't always see the surveillance, right? Yeah. Even as it's happening all around us. Ira J. Allen, another key voice in our sources, really emphasizes this invisibility. He argues that if something powerful is hard to see, it tends to be even more powerful. So it's not just a physical hiding then, it's like a conceptual one too.
Exactly. Allen elaborates on this with a really powerful concept he calls the datafication of bodies. In this framework, we're no longer seen as like whole complex individuals. Instead, we're decomposed into these discrete data points. Imagine taking a high-res photo and breaking it down into millions of tiny pixels. That's kind of what happens to us digitally. Then, through complex algorithms, these data points are recomposed, they're reassembled, not just on screens for someone to view, but within the algorithms themselves. And these algorithms can actually organize and often predetermine an individual's life chances, what jobs you see, what news you get. Allen argues that UTS acts as a dispositive. It's a system that doesn't, you know, overtly dominate or coerce like old school surveillance might have. Rather, it disposes, arranges, and assembles things behind the scenes. This subtle arrangement encourages what he calls collective participation, a willing or maybe unwitting engagement that wasn't present in older, more obviously coercive forms of surveillance. It promises to produce these media objects that arrange our dispositions, our attentions, even our perceptibilities. It shapes how we see the world and how the world sees us, often without us even realizing the subtle ways our choices are being influenced. It's a profound shift in how power operates in the digital age.
So we're not just being tracked, we're being kind of redefined by data and algorithms. That's a truly unsettling thought. But if we're all being quantified like this, who exactly is doing the quantifying? Is this solely the work of governments, or is there a bigger picture here?
That's a crucial question. And the answer reveals a pretty fascinating dynamic. This initial data accumulation, which Sanchez highlights using Shoshana Zuboff's term behavioral surplus, basically all the digital breadcrumbs we leave behind as we interact online and offline, it was primarily, and still largely is, in the domain of commercial companies. Their motives were, and largely remain, profit-driven. They aim to monetize the surplus through things like highly personalized advertising, tailoring content recommendations, you know, differential pricing for goods and services, even screening potential employees, and some more maybe benign security applications. This was all about understanding and influencing consumer behavior, optimizing markets, creating new revenue streams in the digital economy. That was the initial push.
But then you see this growing, almost irresistible role for states in this landscape. It seems like the costs associated with UTS are decreasing so rapidly that it's becoming increasingly accessible for state security services to adopt these capabilities for their own ends.
That's a critical transition, absolutely, and one that has profound implications. Sanchez points out that a recent global event, the COVID-19 pandemic, for instance, really socialized the notion of state monitoring of citizens, often justified for public health, like contact tracing. This naturally led to widespread fears that security services might be, well, unwilling to relinquish these expanded authorities once the immediate crisis subsided. So this convergence of massive commercial data collection and state access fundamentally blurs the lines between profit and control. It moves beyond just market manipulation into the realm of profound social and political control, sometimes under the guise of public good or national security. So, yeah, what began as a commercial endeavor has definitely morphed into a powerful tool for state oversight.
Okay, let's try and connect this abstract concept of datafication and behavioral surplus to something almost everyone experiences. You know, that feeling when Google knows me too well, when an ad pops up for something you just thought about or maybe just talked about near your phone. Has anyone actually studied how individuals cope with that specific feeling? That feeling of being watched by algorithms?
Absolutely. This is precisely where the research by Dong Zhang and Joanna Streichart, Sophie Borman, Theo Arojo, and Hilde Voorveld comes into play. It's a great study. They directly explored how individuals cope with perceived surveillance specifically in an algorithmic profiling context. To them, algorithmic profiling is that systematic and purposeful recording and classification of data related to individuals to create these comprehensive predictive profiles. You see this everywhere, right? From personalized ads that seem to read your mind to streaming services suggesting your next binge watch. What's particularly insightful from their study is that when you directly inspect your own algorithmic profile, say, by looking at your Google My Ad Center settings, it actually makes the data collection even more evident. It brings that abstract concept right into your personal space. You see the categories, the interests, the demographics that they have assigned to you. It makes it very real. And the study's central finding is quite compelling. It found that the more accurate individuals perceive their algorithmic profiles to be, the more they feel surveilled. It's not just about the raw data being collected. It's about that feeling of being seen and understood by an invisible algorithm. They explain this through the lens of psychological ownership theory. Think of it this way. When an algorithm makes an inference about you, like predicting an interest you have, and it accurately matches your actual, perhaps even kind of hidden interest, it feels incredibly personal, like it's your unique thought or insight. But then when you realize a company also knows this information, that feeling of being watched suddenly becomes much more intense. It's like discovering someone read your secret diary, even if it was just about your favorite, you know, ice cream flavors. It's the shared knowledge that heightens the sense of being observed.
That's a fascinating insight. So if an algorithm successfully reads your mind, it can actually make you feel more exposed, not less comfortable. So what does this all mean for us, the individual user, when we experience this feeling of being surveilled? Do we just accept it, or do we have ways to respond?
Well, the Zhang et al. Study identified 5 key coping strategies individuals tend to employ in response to the state of valence. First, there's privacy protection behavioral intention. Basically, taking concrete steps like going in and adjusting ad settings on platforms, trying to exert some control. Second, privacy cynicism, which is that feeling of uncertainty, powerlessness, mistrust, and just resignation. It's the what's the point, they're going to get my data anyway attitude. Third, self-empowerment, where individuals feel more agency, like they can control their data in this environment. Fourth, downplaying data valence cost. This involves minimizing the perceived harm of data collection, maybe focusing on the benefits like convenience. And finally, sympathizing with the corporation, where individuals develop a more positive attitude towards the company collecting their data, perhaps because they see the utility it provides, like better recommendations. Now, what did the study actually find about how these strategies play out in real life? The insights here are quite revealing. They found that perceived surveillance positively relates to both the intention to adjust ad settings and privacy cynicism, which presents a bit of a paradox, right?
Yeah, you act, but you also feel hopeless.
Exactly. Feeling surveilled can motivate you to take action, but it can also lead to a sense of futility and resignation at the same time. Interestingly, perceived surveillance actually leads to less downplaying of data surveillance costs, suggesting that when you feel watched, it highlights the negative aspects rather than making you minimize them. Furthermore, perceived accuracy, how well you think they know you, also has direct relationships with coping strategies, independent of how surveilled you feel overall. For example, a higher perceived accuracy can lead to lower privacy protection behavior, maybe because you feel it's pointless.
Or maybe you trust them more.
Right. Or it could lead to more self-empowerment or sympathizing with the corporation. It could be due to increased trust in the platform's competence. They're so good at knowing me, I trust them. Or even a sense of negative surprise that drives different coping mechanisms. It's complex.
That's truly fascinating. It sounds like knowing that you're being profiled is one thing, but how accurate that profiling is perceived to be can fundamentally change your reaction.
Yeah.
This leads us to the concept of online privacy literacy, your factual knowledge, your ability to reflect, your skills, your critical understanding of privacy.
Hmm.
Does simply knowing more about privacy help people feel less cynical or more in control when they feel watched?
That's a critical question. And the study found something quite important here. Individuals with higher online privacy literacy, meaning they generally know more about how to protect their privacy online, are not necessarily immune to privacy cynicism when perceived surveillance is high. This is a crucial insight. It shows that simply having the knowledge doesn't always translate into feeling empowered or preventing resignation. You might know what to do, you might know about VPNs or cookie settings, but if the feeling of being watched is strong enough, it can still lead to that cynical attitude where you feel powerless against the sheer scale of data collection. It really underscores the profound psychological impact of UTS, even on those who are well-informed.
So it's not just about what you know, but how you feel about what you know, especially in relation to how pervasive the surveillance feels. That's a truly nuanced point. Okay, now let's shift from the abstract world of data profiles to an even more intimate space, our homes. I'm thinking of that absolutely fascinating 2012 study by Antti Ylösvirta and his colleagues. They looked at the long-term effect of ubiquitous surveillance right there, inside people's homes. Tell us about that. This sounds like a pretty extreme experiment.
Oh, it was extraordinary and quite extreme, yes. Designed to probe the very limits of privacy, researchers instrumented households with just a shocking array of sensors, multiple video cameras, keyloggers on PCs, capturing every single key press, mouse clicks, full screenshots every 60 seconds,
oh.
Network traffic monitoring, data from smartphone sensors, logging TV and DVD usage, tracking changes in the device environment via Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. They even collected paper copies of monthly customer card reports for groceries and things. The key here, as you said, is that this wasn't public surveillance. This was done inside people's homes, traditionally considered the last bastion of privacy. The researchers really wanted to see what happened when that final private space was invaded, how deeply it affected daily life. And the emotional and psychological impact reported by the subjects was incredibly vivid, often quite disturbing. The camera image, for instance, was frequently described as an eye that watches, or penetrating, creating this constant awareness of being observed. Subjects reported it was particularly disturbing when it might capture arguments or, you know, when one was doing something stupid. Concerns about capturing the body were really prominent. Subjects would avoid walking naked. They'd fix their towels meticulously after showers. They reported feeling a profound loss of safety. Even sexual activities were impacted because of the camera's presence.
Just the awareness it was there.
Exactly. PC logging was disturbing because it captured internet browsing, maybe work-related material. Subjects felt they should have more privacy on a computer than even with friends physically present. Network logging was disturbing due to the capture of recognizable personal data, like websites visited. And interestingly, subjects expressed a grave concern about public viewing. They feared their data would be turned into some kind of commercial drama, like a reality show. They worried about leaks to authorities or even friends. It really highlighted the visceral discomfort with pervasive observation in one's private sanctuary.
That's a powerful illustration of just how deeply this kind of surveillance can affect individuals emotionally. It makes you wonder, beyond the emotional impact, What did people actually do differently in their daily lives? What were the observable, tangible changes in their routines and behaviors?
The study observed very concrete privacy-seeking behaviors that people adopted. For instance, there was clear nudity suppression. Subjects started dressing in unmonitored areas, like bathrooms, and generally wore more clothes at home. One subject explicitly said, "I've sort of lost the safety of my own house. Like, if I'm thirsty after a shower, I cannot go and drink in the kitchen. Or I kind of cannot have sex in the kitchen because of the camera." That really shows a profound shift. Communication changes were also noted. Some subjects moved personal conversations to unmonitored bedrooms or even went outside to cafes to talk privately. Others restrained loud voices to prevent shouting or temper outbursts from being recorded. Some even avoided inviting many people home because explaining the setup was awkward. Substance use concealment was another observed behavior. Subjects would hide liquor bottles or illegal substances from the camera's view. In terms of internet browsing changes, some participants decreased their general internet use, while others started using secondary laptops, ones without keyloggers, for sensitive activities like banking or personal emails. One participant even stopped visiting discussion forums where they used to share their deepest secrets, highlighting how pervasive surveillance can stifle expression even in traditionally anonymous spaces. And beyond just changing behavior, subjects actively engaged in sensor manipulation, trying to take back control. Two participants admitted to regularly turning off cameras, sometimes for overnight guests, partners visiting, doing physical exercise, or just because they got angry at the camera.
Just had enough.
Exactly. They used various methods, removing the power socket, covering the lens with cloth or a vase, or playing music loudly to try and obstruct the audio recording. The recurring reason given was privacy of the body and social events, especially during extraordinary moments or romantic encounters. One subject even described turning off the main recording box when old friends came for a party because explaining the whole study was just too difficult and weird. What's particularly striking is the case of the dropout subject. One person discontinued participation after 6 months. This individual articulated that the surveillance became increasingly disturbing over time, realizing there were things in their life that no outsider should know. This feeling was reinforced by the monitoring of their social relationships, phone calls, documents, browsing history, everything. This person resorted to using computers outside the home for sensitive tasks and was the only one in the study to turn off a non-camera sensor specifically, the PC logger, because they were uncomfortable with it recording their online banking activities. It paints a vivid picture of individuals trying desperately to reclaim some agency in a totally surveilled environment.
Those personal experiences really bring home the profound impact of UTS. It's not abstract at all when it's in your kitchen. Now, let's transition from the intimate to the global stage, looking at real-world examples in national security. We'll start with a case from what we might call the pre-digital age, or at least early digital age of the early 2000s, the 2003 abduction of Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser from Milan, Italy. Sanchez refers to this as the Italian job.
Yeah, this case is a remarkable blueprint for how investigations operated before the full bloom of ubiquitous surveillance. Italian prosecutors painstakingly reconstructed the events of this alleged CIA rendition where Nasser was taken to Egypt and allegedly tortured. The breakthrough, as Sanchez details, came from analyzing local mobile phone records. Basic stuff by today's standards. They used cellular phone subscriber data who owned which phone number to track the alleged CIA chief of station from Milan to Aviano Air Base, and then continuously tracking that phone number to Egypt, all the way from the abduction date until he returned to Italy weeks later. This was a classic following the breadcrumbs approach, relying on data that was available, sure, but not necessarily interconnected for rapid analysis. It took legwork. Beyond that, credit card transaction data was instrumental. It linked alleged CIA officers to specific hotel rooms they stayed in. One alleged CIA officer was identified because, despite operating under an alias, they made the critical mistake of contacting their family back in the U.S. from Italy using a traceable method.
Operational security mistake.
Big one. Furthermore, the true name of another alleged CIA officer was discovered through a public record search, specifically U.S. mortgage records, which revealed a loan from a small federal credit union that, it turns out, caters exclusively to CIA agents and their families. A very specific clue. This entire process, though, from the abduction in February 2003 to the significant breakthrough in early 2005, it illustrates the relatively slow, laborious pace of investigations before ubiquitous technical surveillance really picked in. It relied on traditional paper trails, database lookups, more manual correlation. It took years to piece it all together.
Okay, so that's the Italian job, a very manual, painstaking process taking years.
Now, let's fast forward just 7 years to 2010 and the assassination of Mahmoud al-Mabouhou in Dubai. How was that investigation so significantly faster, only a few years later? What changed in those 7 years that made such a difference?
The Dubai job offers a really stark contrast. It truly showcases the rapid acceleration of identification capabilities, thanks to, well, nascent ubiquitous technical surveillance. Dubai authorities, benefiting from massive investments in state-of-the-art security systems that basically blanketed the country, were able to quickly identify the perpetrators much faster. The investigation didn't start with just phone records. Their initial and most potent source was a review of extensive CCTV security footage from across the city. Hotels, airports, streets.
Cameras everywhere.
Everywhere. And this was immediately cross-referenced. Investigators then began to data mine, rapidly sifting through credit card details, hotel registry information, customs data, flight manifests, phone records. Pulling it all together, anomalies jumped out quickly, like the use of two almost identical prepaid credit cards by travelers supposedly from different European countries, with only two digits different in the card numbers. That immediately flagged a professional operation. Crucially, facial recognition software played a major role in identifying the suspects, despite their attempts at disguise, like wearing baseball caps or wigs. The tech was getting better. Even seemingly bizarre behavior, like two agents sitting for 4 hours straight in a hotel lobby dressed in full tennis gear, rackets in hand, raised immediate suspicion. It deviated from normal patterns. It stuck out to algorithms trained on typical behavior.
The algorithm noticed they weren't playing tennis.
Pretty much, it was anomalous. Dubai's sprawling surveillance system meticulously captured everything and allowed for the reconstruction of the alleged Mossad agent's entire timeline. From their arrival using different passports to their movements within the city, the hotel, the assassination itself, and their departure. By the time al-Mabouhou's body was discovered on January 20th, 2010, all members of the assassination team were already out of the UAE. Yet, their every move had been fully recorded. The swiftness of their identification, the primary perpetrators identified within about 30 days, and 26 individuals involved linked within 4 months, clearly demonstrates the rapid advancements in UTS in a very short period. The interconnectedness and sheer volume of these data sources, analyzed by powerful algorithms, it made all the difference. It fundamentally changed how these investigations unfold, much faster, much more data-rich.
That acceleration is truly astounding, from years to months or even weeks. So what feeds this ever-growing surveillance system? And how much data are we really leaving behind? It feels like an unfathomable amount, doesn't it?
You're right. It's an almost incomprehensible volume of this behavioral surplus, those digital trails we leave constantly. Sanchez references a Forbes article that detailed how a typical Google account, just for someone, say, between 25 and 35 years old, can contain 2 gigabytes of information. To put that in perspective, that's approximately 1,356,000 text files worth of data.
Just for one person's Google account.
Just Google. This includes everything from your Google Maps history, where you've been, how long you stayed, your YouTube search and view history, your online search history, your purchase history if you use Google Pay. It's vast. What's even more concerning, perhaps, is that digital natives, those born after 1996, are generating even larger quantities of data. They spend, on average, something like 12 hours a day interacting with digital devices. This means that for intelligence agencies looking to recruit, it will soon be nearly impossible to find candidates with little to no online presence. Everyone is leaving these digital footprints. And Google is far from alone in this, obviously. Companies like Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Twitter, and non-American companies too, like China's Alibaba, which calculates and sells creditworthiness scores based on user data, they all collect similar vast quantities of data. What's critical to understand is that this data, once generated, can exist indefinitely, and it can be queried later. It's not just about real-time tracking. Think about this. Pacemaker data was used in Ohio to charge someone with arson because a cardiologist noted the device data, the heart rate patterns, were inconsistent with his statements about his activity during the fire.
Wow, medical data used in a criminal case.
Exactly. Similarly, Fitbit data was used in a personal injury case to demonstrate how the owner's active lifestyle had deteriorated after an accident. Comparing before and after activity levels. Once this behavioral surplus is created, it's a permanent record, a digital ghost that can be summoned at any time by those with access. This fundamentally changes the game for human intelligence, or Huberin NT officers, those who gather information through human sources. It will be nearly impossible for them to generate and seed the vast quantities of fictitious historical data needed to create a convincing alias persona that just blends into the noise of modern digital life. The backstory has to be incredibly detailed and consistent now. Meanwhile, for counterintelligence, or CI, agents those focused on thwarting foreign intelligence threats, This is a boon. They can now analyze this digital detritus to rapidly verify identities or flag anomalous behavior, like someone checking into multiple hotels on the same day, or financial transactions that don't fit a profile. It's an unprecedented level of scrutiny available to them.
The idea that our past digital actions, however innocuous they seemed at the time, can be perpetually available and potentially used against us, that's truly unsettling. We saw facial recognition play a crucial role back in the Dubai case in 2010. How much further has this technology advanced, and where is it being deployed today beyond just security forces? It seems like it's everywhere now.
It has indeed progressed exponentially since Dubai, leaps and bounds. Take the 2018 Salisbury poisoning in the UK. British authorities used their massive CCTV network, remember? One camera for every 11 citizens, and advanced facial recognition to identify the alleged Russian assassins by cross-referencing camera footage with flight records and visa applications. A retired GCHQ officer remarked at the time that it's almost impossible in England to hide. Almost impossible. Hinting at maybe even more sophisticated capabilities, like identifying individuals by their gait, how they walk, or even specific accessories they wear. China is obviously a leader in deploying this field. They're equipping police officers with camera-enabled glasses for real-time facial recognition against watch lists. Their rapidly expanding network of security cameras funnels data to the Ministry of Public Security, allowing them to review historical data to identify interactions between people over time. Who met whom, where, when. But it's absolutely not just governments. This technology is rapidly integrating into our everyday commercial lives. Think about securing your banking apps with your face, or cars recognizing the driver to adjust seat settings, or retailers tracking your shopping habits to optimize store layouts and prevent theft. Companies like Amazon sell Amazon recognition to law enforcement. Ford and Intel are developing in-vehicle camera systems. Financial institutions like Chase, HSBC, USAA use Apple's Face ID. MasterCard and Ant Financial are experimenting with selfie payments. Cali Burger uses it for loyalty programs. Walmart, dollar stores, pharmacies use it. Hotels use it for check-ins, identifying VIPs. It's proliferating. The industry itself is booming. It was expected to be worth $9 billion by 2020, and it's surely grown since then. Companies like Facebook and Google have achieved astounding accuracy rates. Facebook hit 97.25% recognition way back in 2014. Google claimed 100% on a specific data set in 2015. They achieved this by scraping billions of photos from sites like Flickr or using apps like Everroll to encourage users to tag people, constantly feeding and training their AI. This data is incredibly accessible. While it might be state-controlled in authoritarian regimes, in the West, private companies hold vast amounts of it. But they can often be compelled to provide it to governments via subpoena or other legal processes.
Yeah.
For IOs, human intelligence officers operating under alias, integrating robust facial recognition mitigation into their pattern of life, their established routine and habits, is absolutely critical. However, a significant caution here, and Sanchez emphasizes this point strongly, trying to fool AI with overt disguises, like wearing special glasses designed to confuse algorithms or unusual head coverings, can actually be counterproductive.
How so?
Because AI might flag those very actions as anomalous behavior. The attempt to hide makes you stand out, instantly raising scrutiny rather than preventing it. It's a real challenge.
So we're not just identified by our faces, but potentially by how we try to hide our faces. That's a truly tricky situation at Catch-22 for intelligence operations. Beyond facial recognition, how does the pervasive shift towards a digital economy impact surveillance? It seems like fewer cash transactions would naturally leave more traceable footprints.
Absolutely. The shift to a digital economy is profound. Deloitte defines it as economic activity resulting from billions of online connections, all underpinned by this hyper-connectivity, the internet, mobile tech, IoT. Think about companies like Uber, right? The largest taxi company owns no vehicles. Facebook, largest media owner, creates no content. Alibaba, major retailer, holds no inventory. Airbnb, largest accommodation provider, owns no property. All of these operate exclusively within this digital economy, and crucially, all require linked financial information, credit cards, bank accounts generating vast user data with every transaction. Now connect this back to intelligence operations. Financial transactions were absolutely critical in reconstructing both the Italian and the Dubai operations we discussed. Now authorities can access vast financial data directly from these digital platforms, often bypassing traditional banks entirely, which can accelerate investigations significantly. Every purchase, every rideshare, every online payment becomes a data point that can be tracked, analyzed, and used to build a profile, potentially revealing an agent's true activities or network. Proponents like Harvard professor Kenneth Rogoff tout the benefits of a paperless or less cash economy. They argue it reduces crime, graft, tax evasion, since a large percentage of paper currency, maybe up to 50%, is used to hide illicit transactions. You see developing countries like China, India, Nigeria, Zimbabwe leapfrogging traditional banking systems to implement digital economies, often for efficiency in reaching unbanked populations. China's social credit system, for example, directly leverages digital transactions and other online behaviors to blacklist individuals, impacting their ability to access services like dining out, buying train tickets, or even getting loans. It shows how financial actions can translate directly into social control. However, it's worth noting there is resistance. Some Western states, like New Jersey, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and cities like Philadelphia and San Francisco, have passed laws requiring vendors to accept cash, citing privacy concerns and the impact on lower-income individuals who may not have access to digital payment methods. But for human IOs, this trend towards cashless is a major challenge. It will be increasingly difficult to remunerate agents discreetly using untraceable cash. The age where a turncoat like Aldrich Ames could receive large cash payments from the Soviets and spend lavishly without immediate detection, that's rapidly becoming a thing of the past. For CI personnel, on the other hand, identifying unexpected affluence or unusual transaction patterns in a target will become almost instantaneous through financial data analysis.
So every purchase, every transaction becomes another data point that can be tracked, analyzed, used to build a profile, maybe reveal connections. That's a powerful shift. We mentioned earlier the BBC reporter being located in Guiyang, China, in just 7 minutes using their surveillance network. How is this level of precision location tracking now globally pervasive? And what are the specific technologies enabling it day-to-day for all of us?
That 7-minute location of the BBC reporter was a very stark demonstration, yes. And this level of tracking is indeed becoming globally pervasive. Maybe not always that fast, but the capability is spreading. It leverages multiple modalities, each layering on top of the other, creating a very detailed picture. First, there's cellular tracking, with mobile coverage extending to, 79-93% globally, depending on the region. Your phone is constantly connecting to cell towers just to function. Even simple triangulation using the single strength for multiple towers is incredibly effective for pinpointing location, especially in urban areas. Service providers routinely collect metadata, things like time of connection, tower ID, user data, with increasing precision thanks to 4G and now 5G networks. This enables sophisticated location profiling based on your historical movement patterns. They know your routine, your pattern of life, down to granular detail just from your phone connecting to towers, even if location services are off.
Even if GPS is off.
Even if GPS is off. Which brings us to the second layer, GPS-enabled devices and apps. Services like Apple Maps, Google Maps, Waze, they collect where you live, work, what businesses you frequent, the duration of your stays, your modes of transport, overall travel patterns. This information is aggregated, correlated, analyzed, and often sold, maybe anonymized, maybe not for things like traffic analysis, urban planning, or, as Sanchez notes, to vehicle insurance companies to adjust premiums based on driving habits. Here's a critical point he makes. Even when GPS is disabled by the user or the device is put in airplane mode, location data is continuously collected by other sensors on the phone, like accelerometers or Wi-Fi scanning, and it's then uploaded later when internet access is regained.
So airplane mode doesn't actually stop the collection?
Not the collection, just the immediate transmission, usually. While companies make claim to anonymize this data, security researchers often find it's not that difficult to reassociate it with specific users. So whether you're actively using your phone or not, nearly every step you take in our modern world leaves this digital location trail a permanent record that can be meticulously reconstructed. Third, there's Wi-Fi tracking. Your devices, phones, laptops, tablets constantly scan for nearby Wi-Fi networks, broadcasting their unique MASI addresses. That's a unique identifier for each device's network card. Wi-Fi sniffers, essentially listening devices, like those notoriously used by an advertising firm in London Bins a few years ago, can track individuals' movements passively just by picking up these MASI address broadcasts. They can see which locations you visited, how long you stayed, the routes you took between Wi-Fi hotspots. While Apple and Android introduced MASI address randomization to try and provide some anonymity, security researchers have demonstrated its weaknesses. They can often retrieve the original, true MASI address with over 90% success rate using various techniques. And here's the catch, Sanchez points out. Connecting to free Wi-Fi, like at a coffee shop or airport, always discloses the original MASI address during the connection process. Once your device is associated with a free Wi-Fi service provider's network, it will often recognize that access point later and automatically provide its original MSE address again, even if you don't actively connect, allowing for continuous tracking by that provider. Finally, there's Bluetooth tracking. Devices search for beacons, small, low-power transmitters, often placed in public spaces like stores, museums, airports. Your device broadcasts a unique identifier code when it detects these beacons. This provides much more precise location data than Wi-Fi or cellular, often down to within inches, allowing for micro-location tracking within a building, for example. This technology saw widespread use recently for COVID-19 contact tracing apps. In some places, like Noida, India, using the app was mandatory for a time. A concerning trend highlighted in the sources is that data collected by these contact tracing apps has sometimes been made available to intelligence services. For instance, Israel's Shin Bet was granted access to track citizens. For IOs, human intelligence officers, the problem is that most countermeasures available to the public are geared toward protecting users from criminals or advertisers, not determined state actors. Authorities can compel service providers, app developers, beacon operators to hand over data via subpoenas or national security letters. This means IOs must understand that far more robust operational security measures are needed to limit all forms of location data divulged, far beyond simply turning off GPS or using randomized AMSIs.
The layers of tracking are truly mind-boggling. Cellular, GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. It feels like there's almost no way to move without leaving some kind of trace. Now let's talk about a technology that's historically been this cat and mouse game between offense and defense. Encryption. How are current trends shaping its future, especially with regard to ubiquitous technical surveillance? Is encryption still a reliable shield?
That's a great way to put it, a cat and mouse game. And historically, throughout human communication, the pattern has been that given enough time, resources, and ingenuity, encryption can be broken. We've seen this with famous examples like the German Enigma code during WWII, the Japanese Purple Lee diplomatic code, and the Venona decrypts by the U.S. that exposed Soviet spy rings during the Cold War by breaking their one-time pad messages due to key reuse errors. The National Security Agency itself notes that while it took almost 2 years to break certain KGB encryption in the Venona program, the information gained provided crucial insight into Soviet intentions and widespread espionage activities. This historical pattern strongly suggests that no encryption method should be considered permanently impenetrable, especially against well-resourced state actors. The most significant threat on the horizon now to modern encryption as we know it is quantum computing. Theorized since 1982 by the physicist Richard Feynman, quantum computing utilizes quantum mechanics to perform calculations far beyond the capability of classical computers. It's considered the potential destructor of the present modern asymmetric cryptography, the foundation of most secure communication online today, like RSA and ECC.
Destructor. That sounds serious.
It is. What that means in simpler terms is that a sufficiently powerful quantum computer could theoretically break even our strongest current public key encryption methods relatively easily, rendering much of our secure infrastructure vulnerable. Crucially, quantum computing is rapidly transitioning from being purely theoretical to being operational in laboratories. Researchers are making rapid progress, building larger and more stable quantum processors. The implication is stark. Messages encrypted with today's standard technology will likely become vulnerable to decryption as quantum computing matures. Given its powerful, expensive, and currently fragile nature, the early adopters of this technology will undoubtedly be states, which will significantly enhance ubiquitous technical surveillance capabilities down the line, allowing security services to potentially decrypt stored emails, secure messages, financial transactions, and other encrypted information that wasn't protected by new quantum-resistant cryptographic techniques. Unfortunately, as Sanchez points out, many users are unaware of the pitfalls of readily available secure messaging apps like Wickr, Signal, Telegram, and WhatsApp. Even when they offer strong end-to-end encrypted features, the messages themselves still travel via internet backbones, the core infrastructure of the internet, which are vulnerable to state surveillance and data interception. As Joseph Masco notes in related research, these taps on internet infrastructure can capture and copy vast amounts of digital traffic, encrypted or not. The encrypted data can then be stored for later decryption attempts, perhaps using future quantum capabilities. Furthermore, if internet backbones don't naturally traverse a specific state's digital infrastructure, that state can sometimes simply reroute internet traffic to flow through their own infrastructure, allowing them to capture it. Sanchez cites examples where internet traffic from the U.S. has been routed through both Russia and China on multiple occasions, including a notable incident where Pentagon traffic was inadvertently routed through Beijing for a period. And what about virtual private networks, or VPNs? While they offer an additional layer of encryption and can mask your IP address, they are explicitly outlawed in many countries, including places like Belarus, China, Iran, Russia, the UAE. These countries often perform deep packet inspections, or DPI, which is essentially a sophisticated method to analyze the content and type of data flowing through their networks in fine detail, specifically to identify and block VPN traffic. Moreover, VPNs don't block your device from broadcasting its MEC address during Wi-Fi scans, and they can't prevent mobile devices from collecting and later uploading location metadata that was gathered even when the device was supposedly offline in airplane mode. For IOs, human intelligence officers, this means they must take incredibly robust steps to obfuscate their digital communications. And crucially, as Sanchez warns, they must never transmit any source-identifying information or truly sensitive operational details via unapproved, potentially compromised communication modalities. The specter of future Venona-style decrypts using quantum computers looms large, making today's encrypted communications potentially transparent to future adversaries who store the data now.
It's truly a race against time, then, where the technology of decryption is always catching up and potentially outpacing the technology of encryption, especially with quantum on the horizon. Speaking of prediction, let's shift focus slightly. From simply tracking individuals to actually predicting their behavior based on all this data, what exactly is reality mining? That sounds predictive.
Reality mining is precisely that. It's the process of aggregating and correlating these vast amounts of behavioral surplus, all those digital breadcrumbs from phones, apps, sensors, using statistical analysis, and increasingly machine learning. Unlike traditional methods like surveys, which rely on self-reported data, reality mining provides, as researchers put it, a second-by-second picture of individual and group interactions, often over extended periods. It works by establishing a very precise baseline of routine activities for an individual or a group. What time do they usually leave home? What routes do they take? Who do they communicate with most often? Once this detailed baseline is established, anomalous behavior deviations from the routine can be discerned much more easily and quickly. It's about spotting the unusual against a backdrop of the quantified usual, and this is far beyond theoretical applications. It's happening now. Google, for instance, can already predict things like unemployment rate fluctuations or flu epidemics more accurately, or at least faster, than some state agencies, simply by mining aggregated search queries and related behavioral surplus data. India reportedly uses reality mining techniques to help track terrorists by analyzing communication patterns and movements. China employs it extensively as part of its system to monitor its ethnic Uyghur population, leveraging this predictive power for social control. For IOs seeking to obfuscate their association with intelligence services, reality mining makes this far more difficult. Research on human movement patterns, for example, has highlighted that individuals tend to form distinct subgroups or communities, with surprisingly little mixing between them in their daily routines and digital interactions. This means that if one IO operating undercover is unfortunately identified, reality mining techniques powered by AI can potentially help identify additional IOs in their network simply by analyzing their behavioral associations. Who do they meet with, even briefly? Who do they call? Whose digital paths cross theirs regularly? It helps connect the dots that might otherwise remain unseen in the noise. It's not just about who you are, but who you associate with, digitally and behaviorally.
That's a powerful tool, not just for identifying what's happening now, but for predicting what might happen next and who might be connected to whom, based purely on behavioral patterns. How does AI move beyond just tracking behavior to understanding who we are fundamentally and even how we feel? This sounds like a leap into truly personal, almost psychological surveillance.
It absolutely is a leap into truly personal surveillance. AI is now deeply involved in what's called personality profiling. This is often based on the widely accepted Big Five psychological model, which categorizes personality traits like surgency or extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and openness to experience. AI models infer an individual's personality profile from analyzing vast data sets, particularly things like social media posts, communication styles, online behavior, even purchasing habits. The goal is to predict how individuals with certain personality profiles are likely to react in different situations or respond to different messages. This is obviously valuable for marketers trying to tailor persuasive messages.
But also for intelligence agencies.
Precisely. It's also deeply relevant for security services who can use this to understand potential needs, motivations, or vulnerabilities of individuals, whether they are potential recruits, threats, or even their own personnel. AI can even adapt system behavior in response to a user's inferred personality, perhaps showing different information or using a different tone. We see extensive government adoption of this kind of algorithmic assessment already. The U.S. government, for example, has mandated continuous evaluation, CE, and later continuous vetting, CV, programs for all individuals holding security clearances. This was mandated by Executive Orders 13467 and 13764. These programs leverage automated, ongoing checks of commercial and government databases to flag potential issues in near real time. Things like sudden credit problems, suspicious financial transactions, unreported foreign travel, criminal activity, or potential links to terrorism. As one director of the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency put it, I can find something out on a clearance holder tomorrow that the clearance holder did yesterday, highlighting the real-time nature of this algorithmic assessment of risk. Booz Allen Hamilton, a major defense contractor, even applies similar continuous evaluation principles to all its 27,000 employees, operating under the assumption that if an employee can't handle their personal life responsibly, they can't be trusted with classified information. Foreign adversaries are also undoubtedly leveraging stolen data to build these profiles. The massive OPM hack, which compromised detailed personnel records of over 20 million current and former federal employees, and the Equifax hack, affecting the financial data of 145 million Americans, both widely attributed to Chinese state actors, provide enormous data sets. These allow their AI systems to potentially profile American intelligence officers, government officials, and contractors, identifying potential vulnerabilities or pressure points, greatly enhancing their counterintelligence and targeting capabilities. Airport security profiling, like that used by Israel's El Airline and the US TSA, relies heavily on intelligence-driven, risk-based analysis. This uses secret algorithms that process passenger data itineraries, length of stay abroad, travel documents used, frequent flyer numbers, travel histories to assign a risk score and determine the level of screening needed. Singapore's Changi Airport, known for its technological advancements, uses an AI system called Total Airport Management System to monitor travelers from the moment they book their ticket until they arrive, even flagging anomalous luggage handling, such as someone repeatedly leaving and returning to their luggage unattended. Now, the real cutting edge here is emotional AI, sometimes called an emotions chip or affective computing. Affectiva, a company spun out of the MIT Media Lab, is a pioneer in this field. They developed AI that can sense and analyze human facial expressions and vocal tones to interpret emotions. Their technology has been trained on a massive dataset, over 4 million faces analyzed across 75 countries, amounting to over 50 billion emotion data points. This allows their AI to recognize nuances in expressions like smiles, frowns, surprise, confusion, etc., with high accuracy. This technology allows applications to become emotion aware and adapt their behavior in real time based on the user's perceived emotional state. While it's currently used mostly by marketers to gauge reactions to ads or products, the future vision includes sensors embedded in personal devices, phones, cars, smart homes that constantly analyze your emotions and adjust the device's behavior accordingly, perhaps changing the music playlist if you seem stressed or modifying the newsfeed if you seem agitated.
That raises huge questions about agency and manipulation.
Absolutely. And think about the implications for IOs and CI personnel. Sanchez paints a vivid, if chilling, scenario. Imagine a hostile IO beginning a surveillance detection route, trying to see if they're being followed. Their natural adrenaline and stress might cause subtle microfacial expressions, maybe a fleeting look of fear or heightened alertness. These could potentially be noticed by ubiquitous technical surveillance systems, security cameras on the street, cameras in wearables, sensors in vehicles equipped with this kind of emotional AI. This could then alert CI personnel in real time, instantly raising suspicion based on something subconscious, an involuntary emotional tell.
That's truly dystopian, the idea that a machine could read your subconscious reactions and flag you as suspicious. Feels like all these threads, the data collection, the tracking, the profiling, the emotional analysis, all come together in what is arguably the ultimate manifestation of this surveillance.
Yeah.
The concept of smart cities. How do these urban environments become the ultimate surveillance hub, integrating everything we've discussed?
You're exactly right. Smart cities represent the ultimate convergence, the physical embodiment of all these UTS technologies working in concert. They are literally being engineered, often from the ground up or through major retrofits, to be surveillance and data collection hubs, integrating all the individual pieces we've discussed into one interconnected system. Consider the scale of just the camera infrastructure we mentioned earlier. London with approximately one CCTV camera for every 22 residents, Beijing one for every 76, Washington DC one for every 24, and that's just visible cameras.
Right, not counting all the other sensors.
Exactly. This isn't just about cameras. It's about a comprehensive, interconnected infrastructure designed for data gathering. smart city projects like Barcelona's well-known 22-it district or initiatives in many other cities integrate high-tech corporate fiber optic networks, citywide Wi-Fi mesh networks, vast arrays of environmental and traffic sensors, public Wi-Fi hotspots, all creating the seamless, ubiquitous infrastructure. It's designed for information gathering, resource management, like optimizing traffic flow or energy use, and providing services, all powered by analyzing the behavioral surplus generated by the city and its inhabitants. Cellular towers, sound sensors that can detect anomalies like gunshots or car crashes, and ubiquitous video cameras literally blanket these urban areas, feeding data into centralized command centers. Leading smart cities often cited include places like New York, London, Paris, Tokyo, Singapore, Seoul. But cities of all sizes globally are adopting this concept or elements of it, driven by promises of efficiency, sustainability, safety, and economic growth. For human operations, operating unobserved in such densely sensored environments will become incredibly challenging, perhaps almost impossible in the traditional sense. The era of easily hiding in plain sight is truly nearing its end because there is very little plain sight left to hide in. Every corner is potentially observed, recorded, and analyzed. Conversely, for CI officers, this dense sensor environment provides an unprecedented plethora of data. It offers the potential to reconstruct the activities of hostile agents with incredible detail, offering a digital blueprint of their every public move, meeting, and interaction within the city limits.
So, given this truly pervasive and rapidly advancing reality, this near-total surveillance environment in places like smart cities, is true resistance even possible? Or are we, as Ira J. Allen suggests, merely negotiating ubiquitous surveillance rather than escaping it entirely? What options do we have?
Allen offers a very sobering perspective here, and it's worth reflecting on. He argues that many individual actions we take to protect privacy, like downloading JavaScript-blocking plugins for our browsers, using VPNs, putting tape over our webcams, or even resorting to burner phones for sensitive calls. These actions are, when viewed against the vast, large-scale social, economic, and political structures driving ubiquitous surveillance, simultaneously profoundly important and deeply meaningless.
Important and meaningless. How so?
Important on an individual level, perhaps. They might help an individual sleep easier by providing a temporary sense of control or security. They might thwart some low-level tracking by advertisers or criminals. But Allen argues they are ultimately meaningless, or at least deeply inadequate, for achieving real systemic change against the power of state surveillance or the fundamental business models of major tech companies built on data extraction. We saw hints of this in the Ulisverda home surveillance study. Despite profound discomfort, the behavioral changes people made were often limited, localized, or easily circumvented by the pervasive nature of the sensors. Subjects found ways to cope and continue their lives within the system rather than fundamentally dismantling or escaping it because the system was so totalizing within that context. Allen emphasizes that what's truly needed is not just individual resistance, but collective negotiation. He suggests that screening, that is, actively representing, discussing, debating ubiquitous surveillance in popular culture, in art, in academic discourse, and developing collective subjectivities around privacy and data rights. These are crucial steps for imagining and ultimately achieving better possibilities. It's about fostering cultural and social shifts in understanding and expectation, demanding different technological designs and legal frameworks, rather than relying solely on individual privacy hacks or attempts at personal digital camouflage against an overwhelming system.
That's a powerful and, yeah, somewhat bleak assessment of individual agency in this new reality. It puts the onus on collective action and changing the system itself. So, for the intelligence professionals listening, let's bring it back to Sergio Sanchez's core question that framed our discussion. Is ubiquitous technical surveillance counterintelligence bliss or nightmare? How does he ultimately answer that?
For CI personnel, the counterintelligence officers, Sanchez concludes that UTS is pretty unequivocally a bliss, or at least a massive advantage. It offers unprecedented opportunities to partner with industry to gain access to massive data sets. Think about Facebook's global photo database combined with the potential processing power of quantum computing for near-perfect facial recognition, for example. It allows them to use reality mining techniques to quickly narrow down suspect lists, connect previously unknown associates, and maximize limited investigative resources by focusing on the highest probability threats identified through data analysis. This creates an incredibly difficult, almost transparent operating environment for hostile IOs trying to conduct espionage. The digital needle in a haystack is now much smaller for CI, and the magnet they wield is much, much stronger, enabling quicker identification, disruption, and neutralization of threats. Conversely, for human IOs, the human intelligence officers trying to recruit sources and gather intelligence often in hostile environments, Sanchez concludes that ETS is undoubtedly a nightmare. Operations become inherently more difficult, more risky, and require far more sophisticated tradecraft. UTS effectively turns virtually all states, even previously permissive environments, into hard targets, where traditional methods of blending in, maintaining cover, and communicating securely are rapidly becoming obsolete. Sanchez offers key recommendations for how the intelligence community needs to adapt to this new reality. For CI, the focus should be on fostering even closer collaboration with industry partners to leverage cutting-edge computing power, like AI and eventually quantum computing, and to gain lawful access to the large behavioral datasets held by the private sector. For HUMINT, the path forward likely involves developing new operational models and potentially new types of partnerships, perhaps similar to the NSE's Five Eyes Signals Intelligence Sharing Agreement, but for human operations. Cooperating more closely with allied services to operate in regions where those allies might have greater access, influence, or perhaps slightly less pervasive domestic surveillance penetration. IOs themselves must become acutely aware of their digital footprint, their associations, their interactions, both online and offline, as these can all be tracked and analyzed. They need to establish incredibly consistent, disciplined patterns of life that proactively account for ubiquitous technical surveillance. This means implementing measures like disabling GPS and Wi-Fi where not needed, using VPNs and encrypted communications correctly, but critically, acknowledging their inherent limitations against determined state actors who control the network infrastructure or possess advanced decryption capabilities. And here's that critical caution Sanchez emphasizes again, specifically for IOs. Trying to fool ubiquitous technical surveillance using overt disguises like those special glasses meant to confuse facial recognition or unusual head coverings or constantly changing clothing styles is likely a mistake. AI is increasingly being trained to specifically flag such actions as anomalous behavior, instantly drawing more scrutiny, not less. The intelligence community must think beyond superficial countermeasures. The focus has to be on fundamentally changing operational methods, perhaps relying more on cyber you might tea or remote operations where possible, not just trying to mask an old approach in a new transparent environment.
That's a stark reality check for those operating in the shadows. The old ways are dying. We're dead. Finally, given everything we've discussed today, the pervasiveness, the datafication, the predictive power, the limits of resistance, does this mean we're truly living at the end of privacy as we traditionally understood it?
Richard Miller, an author cited by Ira Allen, makes a compelling, if provocative, argument that essentially, yes, we are living after the end of privacy. He suggests that what it means to be human is changing because everything that can be seen and everything that can be put into words can now be instantly shared on screens the world over. It's a fundamental shift in the human condition, driven by technology. And to echo Sergio Sanchez's final thought in his article, drawing on George Orwell's famous adage from 1984, who controls the past controls the future. Sanchez applies this to UTS. Once behavioral surplus is collected, aggregated, correlated, analyzed, and monetized or weaponized, it is stored indefinitely. And theoretically, it becomes available to all interested parties, corporations, governments, perhaps even malicious actors with sufficient resources or access privileges. The past, our digital past, is becoming increasingly permanent, searchable, and accessible. And that accessible past truly shapes our present opportunities and future possibilities in ways we're only beginning to comprehend.
That's a powerful thought to conclude on. This deep dive has truly highlighted the profound and, frankly, often unsettling impact of ubiquitous technical surveillance on us as individuals, on commerce, and certainly on national security operations. It's a world where our very existence is increasingly datafied, quantified, and stored.
And this deep dive really reinforces our core belief here at the Security Nexus. Knowledge is most valuable when it's understood and applied. In a world facing ever-increasing information overload and this constant quantification of life, cultivating critical thinking is absolutely essential. Understanding these powerful technological and social forces is the first vital step toward navigating them effectively and perhaps collectively deciding what kind of future we want to build in their presence.
Absolutely. And we encourage you, our listeners, to visit thesecuritynexus.net for more actionable knowledge and insights into strategic security policy and related topics. So we leave you with this thought: in a world where our every action can be quantified and potentially stored perpetually, what new forms of societal interaction, trust, and even personal identity might emerge when privacy, as we've known it, is fundamentally reshaped by pervasive, quantifiable observation? How do we cultivate a sense of self-efficacy and agency, both individually and collectively, in this new, hyper-transparent reality? Thank you for diving deep with us.